For there is only one consciousness, the lower being an imperfect representation of the higher, and in no way separate from it. Thus, instead of thinking of raising ourselves till we can unite with the glorified higher self, we should realize rather that the higher is the true self, and that to unite the higher to the lower really means to open out the lower, so that the higher may work more freely and fully in and through it. A man should thus endeavor to become certain, beyond the possibility of doubt, that he is the spirit or higher self. He should develop confidence in his own powers as the ego, and courage to use those powers freely. Instead of looking upon his usual state of consciousness as natural and normal, and looking upwards towards the ego as a lofty being to be reached by continuous and tremendous effort, he should learn to look upon his ordinary state of consciousness as abnormal and unnatural, and upon the life of the spirit as his own true life, from which by continuous effort he keeps himself estranged. Expressed in terms of form, when the lower vehicles are fully in harmony with the ego, they form themselves in the likeness of the orgiades, cp. 237. They then change very little from life to life. Similarly, when the ego is becoming a perfect reflection of the monad, he also changes but little, though he continues to grow. Those who would deliberately undertake the task of bringing the higher consciousness into the brain may do so by a careful training of the lower mind and of the moral character, by steady and well-directed effort. The habit of quiet, sustained, sequential thought, directed to non-worldly subjects, of meditation, of study, also develops the mental body and renders it a better instrument. The effort to cultivate abstract thinking is also useful, thus raising the lower mind towards the higher, as well as drawing into the mental body the subtlest materials of the lower mental levels. This diagram is an attempt to give some idea of the relationship between the ego and his lower vehicles, of the powers, faculties, and knowledge of the ego on his own plane. Only a small fraction can be transmitted to the mental body, from this again, still less penetrates to the astral body, and of this but a fragment reaches the consciousness in the physical body. One of the aims of the man should be, as we have seen, so to widen and strengthen the link between the ego and the lower bodies that more and more of the powers of the ego can find expression in the lower vehicles of the personality. Above and beyond the ego resides the monad, whose relationship to the ego is somewhat similar to that which exists between the ego and the personality. Chapter 30 to Rebirth. We now take up the story of the ego and his vehicles at the point where, the period of life on the higher mental plane being ended, the time comes for a fresh incarnation to be undertaken. It will be recollected that when the ego withdraws into the causal body, he takes with him his physical and astral permanent atoms, and his mental unit or molecule. These particles of matter, one only of each of the three lower planes, remain with the ego throughout the whole of his human incarnations. Whilst they are withdrawn into the causal body, they are in a quiescent or latent condition. When the time for reincarnation comes, the ego turns his attention outwards, whereupon a thrill of life from him arouses the mental unit and the life web begins to unfold itself. This life web consists of Buddhic matter, and appears a shimmering gold of inconceivable fineness and delicate beauty. It is formed of a single thread, which is a prolongation of Sutratma. Into further details of these matters, however, we cannot enter here. The writer hopes to deal with them in a later volume. The mental unit now resumes activity, because the ego seeking to express himself once more on the lower mental plane, so far as the plasticity of its matter will permit. Accordingly, the mental unit acts as a magnet, drawing round itself mental matter and mental elemental essence, with vibratory powers resembling, or accordant with, its own, and thus fitted to express its latent mental qualities. The process is in a certain sense automatic, though devas of the second elemental kingdom assist in the process by bringing suitable materials within reach of the mental unit. The matter is first shaped into a loose cloud around the mental unit. It is not as yet a mental body, but merely the materials out of which the new mental body will be built. Neither are the qualities as yet in any way in action. They are simply the germs of qualities, and for the moment their only influence is to secure for themselves a possible field of manifestation, by providing matter suitable for their expression in the mental vehicle of the child. The germs or seeds, brought over from the past, are known by the Buddhists as the skandhas. They consist of material qualities, sensations, abstract ideas, tendencies of mind, mental powers. As we have seen, in the course of our study, the pure aroma of these passed with the ego into divajan. All that was gross, base and evil, remained in the state of suspended animation spoken of. These are taken up by the ego as he passes outwards towards terrestrial life, and are built into the new man of flesh, which the true man is to inhabit. The experiences of the past do not, of course, exist as mental images in the new mental body. As mental images they perished long ago when the old mental body perished. Only their essence, their effects on faculty, remain. Precisely the same thing happens when the ego turns his attention to the astral permanent atom, and puts into it his will. Thus the mental unit and the astral permanent atom attract to themselves material capable of producing a mental and an astral body of exactly the same type as the man had at the end, respectively, of his last mental and astral lives. In other words, the man resumes his life in the mental and astral worlds just where he left it last time. A man's mental and astral bodies, taken on for his new life period, being thus the direct result of his past, form a most important part of his ripe or prarabdha karma. The mental matter is at first evenly distributed throughout the ovoid. Only as the little physical form comes into existence are the mental and astral matter attracted to it. They then begin to mold themselves to its shape, and thereafter steadily grow along it. At the same time, with this change in arrangement, the mental and astral matter is called into activity, and emotion and thought appear. It should be noted that the coarser the kinds of mental matter built into the mental body, the more intimate becomes the association between the mental and astral matter, thus strengthening the element of karma manas. See Chapter 6. A young child thus cannot be said to have a definite mental or a definite astral body, but he has around and within him the matter out of which these bodies are to be constructed. He possesses tendencies of all sorts, some good, some evil. Whether these germs will develop once more in the new life into the same tendencies as in the last life will depend very largely upon the encouragement or otherwise given to them by the surroundings of the child during his early years. Any of them, good or bad, may be readily stimulated into activity, or, on the other hand, may be starved out for lack of that encouragement. If stimulated, it becomes a more powerful factor in the man's life this time than it was in his previous existence. If starved out, it remains merely as an unfructified germ, which presently atrophies and dies out, and does not make its appearance in the succeeding incarnation at all. During his early years, the ego has but little hold over his vehicles, and he therefore looks to his parents to help him to obtain a firmer grasp, and to provide him with suitable conditions. Hence the enormous responsibility resting upon parents. It is impossible to exaggerate the plasticity of the child's unformed vehicles. Plastic and readily impressible as is the physical body of a young child, his astral and mental vehicles are far more so. They thrill in response to every vibration which they encounter, and are eagerly receptive with regard to all influences, whether good or evil, which emanate from those around them. As in the case of the physical body, whilst the mental and astral bodies are in early youth susceptible and easily molded, they soon set and stiffen and acquire definite habits which, once firmly established, can be altered only with great difficulty. To a far larger extent than is ever realized by even the fondest parents, the child's future is under their control. If we can imagine our friends with all their good qualities enormously intensified, and all the less desirable features weeded out of their characters, then we can picture to ourselves the results which parents can produce in their children if they will do their full duty by them. The extraordinary sensitiveness to the influence of his surroundings commences as soon as the ego descends upon the embryo. Long before birth takes place, it continues, in most cases, up to about the period of maturity. The mental body, or rather the material out of which the mental body will be built, becomes involved with the lower vehicles during the prenatal life. The connection becomes more and more close until, at about the end of the seventh year, the lower vehicles are as closely in touch with the ego as the stage of evolution permits. The ego then, if sufficiently advanced, begins slightly to control his vehicles, what we call conscience being his monitory voice. During the prenatal period, the ego broods over the human mother in whom his future body is building, but the ego can affect the embryo but little, save through a feeble influence from the physical permanent atom. The embryo cannot respond to, and therefore does not share, the thoughts and emotions of the ego expressed in his causal body. The Hindus had various ceremonies by which they surrounded with pure influences both mother and child before and after birth. The object was to create special conditions which warded off the lower influences and brought in the higher influences. Such ceremonies were very valuable. The seeds of evil which are brought by a child in his permanent atoms have often been called original sin, though they are wrongly connected with the fabled action of Adam and Eve. In the Christian Church, the sacrament of baptism is intended specifically to help in reducing to a minimum the effects of the seeds of evil. To this end, magnetized or holy water is employed. By its means, the priest is able to set strongly in vibration the etheric matter of the child's body, to stimulate the pituitary body, and through it affect the astral body and through that in turn the mental body. The force which is poured in rushes down and up again until, like water, it finds its own level. The exorcism performed by the priest is intended to bind down the germs of evil in their present condition, and to prevent them being fed or encouraged in any way, so that eventually they atrophy and fall out. In addition, in the ceremony as performed in the liberal Catholic Church at least, the priest making the sign of the cross down the whole length of the front and back of the child's body, builds a thought form or artificial elemental which has given rise to the idea of the baptismal guardian angel, which is filled by the divine force, and which is also ensouled by a higher kind of nature spirit known as a self. The thought form is a kind of cuirass of white light before and behind the child. Incidentally, through association with the thought form which is permeated by the life and thought of the Christ himself, the self eventually individualizes and becomes a seraph. Even if the child dies almost immediately, the baptism may be of value to it on the other side of death. For it would be quite possible for the germs of evil to be stimulated into activity in the astral world, and the thought form may be of assistance in preventing such action. Thus, in baptism, not only are certain centers or chakrams in the child aroused and open to spiritual influence, but also the germs of evil are, to some extent, repressed, and the child is endowed with what is practically a guardian angel, a new and powerful influence for good. It may be added that the cross which is made on the forehead of the child with the consecrated oil is visible in the etheric double all through the life of the person. It is the sign of the Christian, precisely as the tilaka spot, or caste mark in the case of the Hindu, is the sign of Shiva or the trident of Vishnu. The aura of a child is often a most beautiful object, pure and bright in color, free from the clouds of sensuality, avarice, ill will and selfishness which so frequently darken all the life of the adult. It is pathetic to perceive the change which almost invariably comes over the child aura as the years pass on, to note how persistently evil tendencies are fostered and strengthened by his environment, and how entirely good ones are neglected. With such object lessons before one ceases to wonder at the extraordinary slowness of human evolution, and the almost imperceptible progress which most egos make for life after life spent in the lower world. The remedy lies with parents and teachers, the effect of whose personal character, behavior and habits on the development of children is almost incalculable. It should be unnecessary, at this stage of our study, again to emphasize the great importance of the thoughts and emotions of parents and teachers on their charges. This subject is dealt with at length by C.W. Leadbeater in The Hidden Side of Things, Volume 2, p. 287-312. In the Atlantean civilization, the importance of the office of the teacher was so fully recognized that none was permitted to hold it but a trained clairvoyant, who could see all the latent qualities and capabilities of his charges, and could therefore work intelligently with each, so as to develop the good and amend the evil. In the distant future of the sixth root race, this principle will be applied even more completely. With whatever care parents may surround a child, It is practically inevitable that the child will someday encounter evil influences in the world, which will tend to stimulate evil tendencies in himself. But it makes a vast difference whether the good or the evil tendencies are stimulated first. In most cases, the evil is awakened into activity before the ego has any hold upon the vehicles, so that when he does grasp them, he finds that he has to combat a strong predisposition to various evils. When the germs of good are tardily aroused, they have to struggle to assert themselves against evil tendencies already firmly established. On the other hand, if the parents, by exceeding care before birth, and for several years after it, have been able to excite only good tendencies, then, as the ego gains control, he finds it easy to express himself along those lines, a habit having been established. If then an evil excitation comes, it finds a strong momentum in the direction of good, which it strives in vain to overcome. The ego, unless he is unusually advanced, has but little command over his vehicles at first, but it must be borne in mind that his will is always for good, because he desires to evolve himself by means of his vehicles, and such power as he is able to throw into the balance will always therefore be on the right side. During the embryonic and infantile life, the ego is carrying on his own wider, richer life, and, as said, gradually comes more and more closely into touch with the embryo. We may note here that the relation of the monad to the universe, in which his consciousness is evolving, is analogous to that of the ego in relation to his new physical body. Since the mental body is a new one, it naturally cannot contain the memory of previous births, in which it had no part. Such memory clearly belongs to the ego, in the causal body, who, together with his permanent atoms, alone persists from one incarnation to another. Hence, a man functioning in the physical world cannot remember his past lives, so long as he remembers only by means of his mental body. In the development of the human body, the gestation period corresponds to the downward course of the elemental kingdoms. From birth to the age of 7, it is considered by many educationists that the child's physical nature should receive most attention. Up to the age of about 14, the development of emotions should have chief consideration. Up to the age of about 21, the teacher should appeal especially to the unfolding of the mind. These last three ages may be taken to correspond to a certain extent to the mineral, vegetable and animal kingdoms. In the first, consciousness is on the physical plane, in the second, on the emotional plane, in the third, the lower mind gradually gains ground, and leads on to the stage when man becomes the true thinker. The long period of middle life is the real human career. The epoch of old age should bring wisdom. This is as yet imperfect in most people, being but an adumbration of the superhuman heights of future attainment. It is necessary to mention here a curious eventuality which, in certain rare cases, may occur when a man is reborn. In chapter 6 we saw how, if a man leads a thoroughly degraded life, identifying himself entirely with the lower, animal nature, and neglecting the higher nature is severed wholly from the higher, and the incarnation is a total loss to the ego. Under such conditions, the ego has become so disgusted with his vehicles that, when death relieves him of the physical body, he casts the others aside also. In fact, he may even during physical life leave the desecrated temple. After death, such an ego, having no astral or mental body, will reincarnate quickly. This being so, the old mental and astral vehicles may not yet have disintegrated, but may, by natural affinity, be drawn to the new mental and astral bodies. They then become the most terrible form of what is known as the dweller on the threshold. Chapter 33 Discipleship. The control, training and development of the mental body, as well, of course, as the astral, form an important part of the work of one who aims at becoming a pupil, or kila, of a master and, later, an initiate of the Great White Brotherhood. The following is a table of the four well-known qualifications for the path which leads to initiation. It will be seen that in practically all of these there is a mental element. The qualifications for the path know. Sanskrit English 1 Vivaka discrimination between the real and the unreal, also described as the opening of the doors of the mind. 2 Vairagya indifference to the unreal, the transitory, and to the fruits of action, non-attachment. 3 Shatsampati: 6 fold mental attributes, 1. Shama, control of thought. 2. Dhamma, control of action. 3. Aparati, tolerance. 4. Titiksha, endurance. 5. Shraddha, faith. 6. Samadhana, balance. 4. Mumuksha, desire. 4. Liberation. Volumes have been written on the qualifications. Here, space will permit of the briefest description only. They are not expected in perfection, but they must be at least partially possessed before initiation is possible. Vivka, the aspirant must learn that the inner life, the life of and for the ego, is the real life. He must learn, as C.W. Leadbeater succinctly puts it, that few things matter much, most things do not matter at all. Needless to say, this does not mean that worldly duties and responsibilities, once undertaken, may or should be neglected. On the contrary, they should be performed by the occultist even more scrupulously and carefully than by other men. It is the spirit in which they are done which matters, the recognition of the aspect of them which is important, and those aspects which are not important. This opening of the doors of the mind, or conversion as it has been called, is precisely that which is spoken of in the Bible: set your affection on things above and not on things of the earth. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Discrimination is much stimulated by the rapidly changing circumstances into which the disciple is generally thrown, with a view to impressing on him the instability of all external things. The life of a disciple is generally one of storm and stress, in order that qualities and faculties may be forced into swift growth and speedily brought to perfection. Virajya, from a recognition of the instability and unsatisfying nature of external things, indifference to them naturally follows. The aspirant becomes indifferent to things that come and go, and more he fixes his attention on the changeless reality that is ever-present. Shama, the need for control of thought has already been amply emphasized in this present volume. The pupil must reduce the chaos of his emotions and thoughts to order. He must eliminate the host of minor interests, and control wandering thoughts. Whilst he still lives in the world, the difficulty of the undertaking is multiplied manifold by the ceaseless pressure of disturbing waves of emotion and thought, which give him no rest, no opportunity to collect his forces in order to make a real effort. Steady, daily practice in concentration and meditation is a method that many find suitable. The aspirant must work with great energy and perseverance to reduce the mental rebel to order and discipline, knowing that the great increase in thought power which will accompany his rapid growth will prove a danger to others and to himself, unless the force be thoroughly under his control. Better give a child dynamite to play with, than place the creative powers of thought in the hands of the selfish and the ambitious. Dhamma, to inner control must be added the control of outer actions. As the mind obeys the soul, so must the lower nature obey the mind. Carelessness in the lower part of human activity must be eliminated. Aparati, the sublime and far-reaching virtue of tolerance, means the quiet acceptance of each man, each form of existence, as it is, without demand that it should be something different, shaped more to one's own liking. Respect for the individuality of others is one of the marks of the disciple. Titiksha, endurance, means an attitude of mind that cheerfully bears all and resents nothing, going straight onwards unswervingly to the goal. The aspirant knows that nothing can come to him but by the law, and the law is good. He must realize that as he is paying in a few short lives the karmic obligations accumulated during the past, the payments must be correspondingly heavy. Shraddha, the very struggles in which the aspirant is plunged, develop in him faith in his master, and in himself, a serene, strong confidence that is unshakable. Samadhana, balance, or equilibrium, grows to some extent without conscious effort during the striving after the previous 5 qualifications. The soul gradually disentangles itself from ties that knit it to the world of sense, the objects in which turn away from abstemious dweller in the body, and soon lose all power to disturb his balance. Balance amid mental troubles of every kind is also necessary, this balance being further taught by the swift changes, mentioned above, through which his life is guided by the ever-watchful care of his master. Mumuksha, the deep, intense longing for liberation, that yearning of the soul towards union with the divine, follows on the attainment of the other qualifications. This adds the last touch to the readiness to enter into full discipleship. Once the longing has definitely asserted itself, the soul that has felt it can never again quench its thirst at earthly fountains. The attainment of this stage makes the man ready for initiation, an adhikari, ready to enter the stream that cuts him off forever from the interests of earthly life, save as he can serve his master in them and help forward the evolution of humanity. This hunger for the things of the spirit appears to be represented in Freemasonry by the inner attitude of the candidate in humbly soliciting to be admitted to the mysteries and privileges of ancient Freemasonry. In this attitude, as every Freemason knows, the emphasis is on the urge from within the candidate himself. No man can tread the occult path on the inspiration of another. In the Buddhist system, the names given to the stage are somewhat different, though the qualifications themselves are the same in effect. The following is the Pali nomenclature: 1. Manodvaravijjana. The opening of the doors of the mind, or perhaps escaping by the doors of the mind. A conviction of the impermanence and worthlessness of mere earthly aims. 2. Parikrama. Preparation for action. Doing right for right's sake, with complete indifference to the enjoyment of the fruit of action. 3. Upacharo. Attention or conduct. 1. Samo. Quietude of thought that comes from control of mind. 2. Dhammo. Subjugation, mastery over words and actions. 3. Upriti, cessation from bigotry or belief in the necessity of ceremonies. Hence, independence of thought and tolerance. 4. Titiksha. Endurance or forbearance, including complete absence of resentment. 5. Samadhana. Intentness, one-pointedness, involving the incapability of being turned aside by temptation. 6. Saddha. Faith, confidence in one's master and oneself. 4. Anuloma. Direct order of succession, signifying that it follows naturally from the other three, intense desire for liberation. 5. Gotrabhu. The condition of fitness for initiation. The student will readily perceive that these qualifications necessarily follow from ego consciousness. For if we can look on life from the world of the ego, we see it in true perspective, that is, with discrimination, and the ego consciousness being disentangled from the lower bodies, desirelessness is inevitable. Further, since conduct will be that of the ego himself, instead of that of the bodies, shatsampatti or control of conduct will necessarily follow. And, as the world of the ego is the world of unity, of love in its widest sense, ego consciousness implies love, a word which is sometimes used to designate, from a somewhat different angle, the last of the four qualities, mumuksha, or longing for liberation. When a man appears to be reasonably near the possession of the necessary qualifications, a master may take him upon probation. This means that the man will remain for a period under very close observation. During the period of probation, the pupil is not in any sense in any kind of direct communication with the master. He is little likely to hear or to see anything of him. Nor as a general rule are any special trials or difficulties put in his way. He is simply carefully watched in his attitude towards all the little daily troubles of life. For convenience of observation, the master makes what is called a living image of the probationary pupil, that is to say an exact duplicate of the man's etheric, astral, and causal bodies. This image he keeps in a place where he can easily reach it, and he places it in magnetic rapport with the man himself, so that every modification of thought or feeling in the man's own vehicles is faithfully reproduced in the image. These images are examined daily by the master, who in this way obtains with a minimum of trouble a perfectly accurate record of his prospective pupil's thoughts and feelings, from which he is able to decide when he can take him into the far closer relationship of the accepted pupil, which relationship we shall describe presently. There is not generally much ceremony in this step. The master gives a few words of advice, tells the new pupil what will be expected of him, and often, in his gracious way, he may find some reason to congratulate the pupil on the work that he has already accomplished. The living image records not only defects or disturbances, it mirrors the whole condition of the pupil's consciousness. it must be remembered that the pupil must achieve not only a passive, but also an active goodness, as a prerequisite for advancement.